This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commmavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 322 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hi, good evening to everybody from beautiful Chicago, where it's really nice until tomorrow morning, and then it's going to be really cold.
That's what happens this time of year.
That's right.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. Hey, Rob. Welcome back. Looking for a good show tonight. It's military aviation night. Yay!
Yeah, David's in his element. Also with us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, guys. It's nice to be back in this country. I'm still lagging behind the jet a little bit, but trying to get over it.
Yeah, you've come all the way. Where did you come most recently from? Hong Kong?
From Hong Kong, right. I was in Taipei and Hong Kong.
And I understand that you are now very, very familiar with the Hello Kitty franchise.
Absolutely. Everything that could possibly be logoed on the airplane was, including the toilet paper. And I brought everyone samples, so I'll be sending them out to you soon.
Oh, good. We're all going to get Hello Kitty memorabilia. That's great.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Matt Fritz. Now, Matt is a senior military leader and leadership author. He's a KC-135 instructor and commander with over 2,000 hours, including combat and combat support. Now, Matt's also a certified acquisition professional. He's a certified emotional intelligence trainer slash practitioner. I'm not sure what that is, but we'll find out.
Oh, we need one, though.
I'm sure we do. Matt's also the author of an instructional book entitled Leveraging Your LinkedIn Profile for Success. And he also actively blogs with other military leaders at generalleadership.com. And he's got a personal blog at advancedvectors.com. So, Matt, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks, Max. I appreciate that. And great to meet you, David, Rob, and Brian. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on board.
Well, we're so happy to have you with us. And I understand that you're also a licensed commercial pilot in addition to all that other stuff. Is that right?
Yes, as my finances allow. And I'm trying to get my two children now in the air themselves. Both of them have already logged their first hour. And I think we're going to continue the Fritz family tradition and get them flying and licensed by the time they're 17.
That's fantastic. Now, do they seem genuinely interested themselves, or are they doing it because daddy wants them to?
Well, I'll tell you, my daughter Taylor is 16, and she is about far more technically minded than I ever was. And I think our short time there at Edwards Air Force Base had a dramatic effect on her. So she has every dream of being a fighter test pilot at some point in her future. So getting in the air every chance she gets is a top priority.
Fantastic. That's great. Love to hear that. All right. Well, as always, we'll start with a review of some current aviation news, including airline profits. Also, an opinion piece on what tomorrow's Air Force will look like. We'll talk about passengers who take down an unruly man at an airport. And also, we're hoping Rob will have some observations for us from last week's NBAA convention. Rob, you going to be able to do that?
Yeah, Rob's hoping for that too, actually.
Okay, good.
So, no, I'll be ready.
All right. David, what's our history segment this week?
We're going to go a little Top Gun in honor of Halloween and the MiG-28 and really what it was masquerading as.
Oh, interesting. All right. We also have an Australia desk coming up. This time, Steve goes solo. I think Grant is off ballooning or something. I'm not sure what Steve will tell us. And in his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson continues his conversation with Marissa Garcia, this time about the latest trends in airline seating. All right, and we'll close up with a little bit of the listener mail that we've received in the past week. And with that, why don't we get started with the news? All right, let's start off with a little bit of commercial aviation news. We see in the New York Times, cheaper fuel leads to record profits at airlines. And some of the third quarter results are in. The airlines are doing pretty well, at least some of them. We see that American Airlines has earned $942 million profit for the quarter. That's a record factoring in the merger. United Continental Holdings, their net income was $924 million, another big one. While Southwest Airlines, they didn't do poorly, $329 million, which is up 27%. Sounds great. They note that contributing to this is we've seen a real decrease in oil prices. Fuel costs have gone down, and that's really contributed to the profits that we're seeing. So some people are asking, well, if profits are up, does that mean fares are going to decrease? Rob, you don't think that's going to happen, huh?
Not really, no. I won't be holding my breath for that.
No, I think so. You know, a lot of times when you see profits like this from the airlines, people assume that, well, how come they're keeping all that money if they're doing so well? Why don't we see some of that flow down to the passengers? And I guess the way I often respond to that is that, well, if you look at their profit picture over time, it swings wildly. Some quarters, some years, you see these huge profits like this for whatever reason. Other times, it's just the opposite, and there's big losses. It's got more variability than I think most other industries.
Yeah, but you know what? I wonder. I haven't done a completely detailed study, but since the airline started going more, breaking out all the costs for everything and charging for everything, I wonder when the last time was they had a really, really awful quarter. I mean, they've had some pretty, pretty nice years the last two or three years.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has been driven by the ancillary fees, right? A lot of income resulting from that.
The what kind of fees?
You know, the bag, you know, all those fees that those airlines charge.
What did you call them?
I don't know. Ancillary.
Ancillary. Ancillary.
Ancillary. Okay. Well, I didn't. I thought maybe he was, you know, speaking some other language.
I think we did
tomato,
this last time.
Tomato, tomato, potato, potato.
Exactly. No, I agree with you. And it really is interesting that they have said, oh, my God, why didn't we do this 20 years ago? You know, it's like nobody ever thought of it. And so now I think they've figured out the way to make money.
They sure have. And, you know, these changes in fuel costs have a big impact because, of course, fuel is often the largest contributor to cost. The article notes that United's fuel cost was down 4.1%. Okay, for the quarter, which sounds like, well, something, but not gigantic. Well, that 4.1% contributed $135 million to their profit. And similarly, Southwest's fuel cost was down 4.4%, and that contributed $64 million to their profit. So, you know, as oil prices go up and down, so do airline profits.
And you know what's really scary? Just having mentioned before we started that I was out in New Mexico where our guest is from, I noticed I could see auto fuel yesterday for $2.50. I think the cheapest I saw it was $2.59 a gallon for regular.
Gee, wow.
And in our neighborhood here outside, just outside Chicago, the cheapest I could find of auto fuel regular at a Mobil was $3.59. So a buck difference. I just, you know, it's just amazing what's happened in the last few months.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, Max, I'm going to say something really unpopular here, but I'm actually okay with the airlines keeping their fares where they are. Let them take this profit, and what I'd like to see them do instead of lower fares is actually increase the quality of the product that they're delivering to the customer. And having just flown...
Oh, boy, you... Okay, Brian.
Yes?
You're new to this show. This comment has come up for 4 or 5 years now. It ain't happening.
I am not new to the show. I've been listening since episode 4. I might be new to the staff, but I'm here. I've been here for a long time. I said it was going to be unpopular. I know I'm dreaming when I say this, but having spent more than 2 million miles on United aircraft and having just flown EVA Air and running into a bunch of United flight attendants in a bus line in Hong Kong, and they asked, well, what's the difference between the two airlines? Oh, that was a fun 20-minute wait for the bus as I got to vent on how they could improve the product and actually satisfy customers.
So how did they take that, though? How did they respond to your, you know, illustrating the difference in the, because of the quality of the service?
Very well. They shook their head mostly and said, I really wish management could listen to you. So, and I understand they're frontline employees. They have to deal with all of the grief and guff that passengers give them. And it's a really difficult job that they have, given the tools that they're given.
Sure.
Like I said, I would just love to see them take some of this money and put it back into the product that they deliver.
I think that would be a good investment for them, you know, a good way to invest in the future of their airline. So, yeah, I know. I'm with you. I'm definitely with you. All right. Hey, let's move ahead into our next topic. This is a military topic. This comes from an article in the National Interest, which is a foreign affairs magazine. It's titled America's Enemies Beware. The U.S. Air Force is set to soar and become even deadlier. Now, this was written by two authors, Robert Spalding III, who's actually a B-2 pilot. He's also a former military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And the other author, Adam Lothar, is a research professor at the Air Force Research Institute. So those sound on the surface like some pretty qualified folks. Well, the point they make is this. They say that they believe that between, well, now and 2035, the U.S. Air Force will come to look very different than it has in the past. Now, they say historically, the Air Force has been defined by its platforms, right? Fighters, bombers, airlifters, refuelers, even surveillance and reconnaissance planes and command and control aircraft. And the authors say the future Air Force will not focus on aircraft types, but instead on the airmen. So let's first look at the basic premise, right, that the Air Force has been defined by its platforms. Matt, does that make sense to you?
Actually, it does. I mean, one thing I can certainly say is the world has gotten very small. You know, thanks to communications. Heck, I'm talking to you guys from four different corners of the U.S.
Right.
And this is something you do every week. The world is very small. We have typically defined ourselves by, you know, and the Navy is probably just as guilty, by the large major weapon systems that make us what we are. So what this article is talking about is that the focus is going to be going upon the airman and the skills that airman brings to the fight. And it's actually kind of a something we've been talking about for a while, how important those individual knowledge skills are to what battle platform we actually bring forward. The combat system of the airman is where the focus is for this article.
And they point out that, for example, during the Cold War, we saw the rise of what they call the bomber barons. So sort of the leadership structure of the Air Force may be sort of based around the projection of, you know, of weapons by bombers. And then we saw sort of the rise of what they termed the fighter mafia with the fourth generation F-15s, 16s, then the F-22s, where, you know, it was focused on smaller aircraft, fast, delivering precision-guided munitions. And then more recently, with the global war on terror, we see the, you know, rise of the remotely piloted aircraft and, you know, some people even thinking about an Air Force in the future that's based on drones and, you know, all unmanned and that sort of thing. But Yeah, Matt, as you say, it's the world is kind of different. It's more, it's almost more of an information age kind of a concept, isn't it? Where, you know, information, intelligence, whatever about your adversaries comes from potentially a variety of sources.
Sure, we've also had our chief of staff at one time was the rise of the special operations warrior, you know, with General Norton Schwartz, who was the chief of staff. Before that, it was the rise of the mobility warrior in Ron Fogelman, who was commanding the Air Force for a while as well. But I truly think what you're going to see in the future is a continued focus on space access and a continued focus on what we're now calling the cyber warrior. And it's a whole new skill set that even we're trying to feel our way through.
So how does a transition of this sort happen in the Air Force? Who sits around and thinks about these things and kind of makes the decisions? Who leads the Air Force as it sort of, you know, morphs or changes over time? How does that work?
Well, when we look ahead where our nation is going, where are the critical technologies going to be? Where are the critical threats and gaps going to be? You know, those things are kind of defined through the president's threat briefing all the way down through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as you refine that, each service is kind of divvied out. These are the focus areas where you're going to focus your energy and efforts. And for all intents and purposes, your money resources as well. And it's kind of like looking at car requirements for the year 2025 or the year 2030. Everything is based upon what you're guessing the future is going to look like. And cyber, unfortunately, for everybody involved, it evolves so rapidly that you know, fortunately for the consumer, but unfortunately for countries and militaries, cyber is a rapidly evolving technology that continues to change based upon not just warriors and militaries throughout the world, but individuals. There's a 12-year-old in Pakistan who could teach you as much about the internet and hacking as any military cyber warrior will be able to do as well. So there's always this evolving capability that has to be planned for.
David, does this all resonate with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's the Air Force has been talking about strategic data for, I guess, since the mid-80s, where we started focusing more on space systems, satellites, and how do you quantify that data and make it actionable? I mean, one of the things that came out of 9/11 for across the board was there was so much data there that, yes, in hindsight, you could connect the dots, but the dots weren't connecting themselves. And that's been a strategic goal for the U.S. military now forever is interconnectivity, being able to have actionable material from the Air Force to the Marines, to the Navy, working seamlessly that all of the services have an interoperability to connect. And yes, the Global Hawk can give information to someone that's down on the battlefield. And how do you get that information and how is it, you know, and it's where the future is going to lie. You're going to have aircraft like F-35s that are going to be talking to each other and giving actionable real-time information, and to the point of dreaming where you have one F-35 targeting for another F-35 or a UAV targeting for a manned aircraft. Those kind of changes are rapid, and if you're looking out 20 or 30 years, they're going to be necessities.
And David, I'll add on there that the biggest challenge in all this is certainly never a lack of data. There are so many sensors out there, whether it be video, audio, you name it, acoustic, could be heat, electronic signature, whatever. So much data out there. The problems are storing it and then finding a way to fuse it together in something you can actually act upon. And that's where I think tomorrow's battles will be fought, will be in cyberspace, fusing that data. And the first person to get inside that OODA loop and manage the situation and manage the battle space will be the one that is able to understand it.
I guess things never stay the same, and you know, we evolve, and the threats change, and we have to compensate for that. And I guess it makes things interesting and exciting.
Well, a prime example of a threat that's changing is we were dealing with Al Qaeda. Now we're dealing with ISIS, and ISIS has got a very active internet presence. They've got
right.
Social, and they're using social media, and you know, the Air Force. you know, 5 years ago or when they were started working on Internet Battle Space, they didn't imagine things like Facebook and Twitter as, you know, communication tools. You know, now almost every squadron has got a Twitter account or a Facebook account. And there's a reason behind that. Besides being a public presence, it's also a learning tool. Like, we've all had to learn about social media.
Sure. All right, good. Let's move on to something completely different. This is an article in Gawker.com. Homophobic man taken down at airport after inciting brawl over queers. So this was a man at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. And some of the folks there described him as maybe drunk, maybe on drugs. But in any event, he started a fight with another man wearing a pink shirt. Interestingly, though, when it got physical, the passengers standing around, they jumped in, they tackled the man, and they held him down until the police officers put him in cuffs. And all this was caught on video, which, of course, as David mentions, with social media is just everywhere. But, I mean, first off, I'd say this was really bad behavior at the airport. Don't you agree?
I think it's bad behavior anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. But the interesting thing, I thought anyway, was the reaction of the bystanders. You know, this was not an example of, you know, people not wanting to get involved. They were standing there watching this thing unfold. And when it turned bad, you know, there was some personal risk to these folks, I think, to jump in and tackle this guy. But this seems to be sort of the way air passengers seem to react these days in a sort of a post 9/11 world.
Yeah, I agree, Max. I think that was one of the things that I thought was most impressive, actually, is that we hear so much about people just standing by and watching. And I think these days, people and airplanes and anything related have a very short fuse.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, tempers flare quickly in people's reaction, whether it's, you know, supporting it or taking action, as we saw here, is happening very quickly. It's very interesting. Very interesting, I think.
Yeah, like I said, when I was on last with Mary Kirby, I wish that I had the ability to choose who could fly and who couldn't. And I think that passenger is one that I'd just love never to get on an airplane ever again.
Now, of course, we put all these items that we talk about, the links to them, in the show notes. And this one in Gawker has the video that you can watch. I just mentioned that the man used some expletives, so I wouldn't play this with some young children around or at work with the volume up, so just to be forewarned. All right, let's finish up the news segment with the NBAA 2014 convention, which was held last week, and Rob was attending. I understand, Rob, that there were about 1,100 exhibitors. They had a number of aircraft, maybe about 100 aircraft that were displayed. And the number I saw for attendance was about 26,000 people, representing 49 U.S. states and 95 countries around the world. So what are your thoughts on the convention?
You just expressed them all.
I took it all away from you. Sorry,
yeah,
Bob.
There's nothing else to say. Actually, has anybody on ever been to the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando besides me?
No.
It is the biggest convention center you have ever seen in your life. They say it's only the second largest. It has 7 million square feet of exhibit space. And wow, in two groups of buildings across the street from one another. And everything's connected by overhead walkways. And on one of the shows, because I was there with one of the airport clients that we work with, we had to go pick up some printing that ended up at the wrong place. And they said, oh, it's not at the FedEx office in the north building. It's at the FedEx office in the south building. Well, wow. I'll just run down and get it. Was that a mistake? I mean, it was almost a mile from where we were to where this thing was, and then a mile back. And, I mean, you just cannot believe how large this place is. So then put 26,000 people in there. Figure maybe, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 weren't there because they were out at the static display that was being held at Orlando Executive Airport. And there were a lot of people there. I mean, it was a busy 3 days. Lots of airplanes, lots of orders, new airplanes announced. Gulfstream came out with a G500 and a 600. And for those of you who hate us talking about business aviation airplanes, I'll try to make it brief for you. but... You know, to those of you that feel that way, I'm sorry. This is the biggest trade show for business aviation in the entire United States. So you'll just have to cut me a little slack on this one.
So, Rob, didn't we have like a 350 and a 650?
The numbers are coming closer together. They'd been using the G450 as the large cabin airplane and the G550 and the G650. And now we have a 500 and a 600 sort of in the middle with the large cabin and different ranges and different price points and that sort of thing. So they're really filling out their product line. Bombardier was there. They had a mock-up of their Learjet 85, which is not being produced yet, but everybody hopes will be soon because they have a lot of orders. They announced an upgrade to the Challenger 605 aircraft that's going to be called the Challenger 650. What else was there? Of course, Embraer gained certification on the Legacy. Let's see, was it the 450 or the 500? I forgot. I'll have to go back and dig, but those are two similar aircraft. But again, they announced that at the show, so the Embraer folks were dancing up and down. Cessna announced the continued process in its new Latitude aircraft, which is a midsize cabin jet. The Dassault people are in the middle of their new aircraft designs, which are the 5X and the 8X to surround the 7X. And then there was the Pilatus jet, which everybody probably knows the Pilatus PC-12, which is that large cabin single-engine turboprop. And Pilatus had the mock-up of its PC-24 there. Of course, the Honda people were there, and we had some folks on talking about Honda not too long ago when I interviewed Andrew Broom up at AirVenture. And that airplane is coming along swimmingly, and there's just lots and lots of activity. And, of course, the one thing you heard from everybody is, boy, we just wish we could sell a few more airplanes. But certainly there is quite a lot to choose from.
Yeah, it sounds like it was kind of an upbeat event.
Well, I think it's probably time. I mean, let's face it. When do we assume that the economy tanked? Was it 2008 or 2009?
Yeah, well, yeah,
I think it was 2008, right?
Certainly 9 was not a good year for business aviation.
No. So then we pretty much remember that it was the fall. It was about this time in 2008 when the world was coming apart. And that was, that was 6 years ago. So they are saying, gee whiz, aren't we due? And so they're, the deliveries still aren't anywhere near where they were prior to the economy tanking, but they are on the upswing. And so, again, everybody was as hopeful as you can be, considering the fact that, the order, there were, again, a fair amount of orders for new airplanes, but again, not near as many as there were, say, 10 years ago. But let's face it, the life in general in the United States is not what it was before the economy tanked, not just in our industry.
Right. All right, Rob, thanks for that.
And Max, real fast, Rob, you said that it was the second largest convention. I'm putting my associate producer hat on here. It's actually 18th in the world. McCormick in your hometown of Chicago is actually larger, and that is number 8 in size.
Really? And what do they say? So McCormick Place is larger than Orange County. Wow.
Yep. McCormick's 204. I'm going to round off here. 241,000 square feet. Orange County is 190,000. Now the convention center in Hanover, Germany, is 448.
Hang on. I mean, when I was talking to the Orange County people, they were giving me millions of square feet, not hundreds of thousands. I mean, they have, they, you know, they said,
I'm sorry, it's square meters.
I'm, oh, now you're going to try to pull one of those European things out of us, right? And make us convert. Max, you're the engineer. What is, how many square thousands or how many thousands of square meters, Brian?
It's a lot. However you look at it.
Oh, it's a lot. Okay.
All right. Again, our guest this episode is Matt Fritz. Matt, again, thanks for joining us. One thing that we mentioned earlier was social media. And we can see that you're personally very engaged in social media. I mean, not only the blog generalleadership.com and your own advancedvectors.com, but you've got a giant Twitter following, over 100,000 followers. And you've published the book, Leveraging Your LinkedIn Profile for Success. So tell us about this kind of engagement and how is that helpful in leading in our modern Air Force?
You got that right. I'm definitely all about communication and probably in just about every form imaginable. I'm a pretty strong believer that open, frank, and I guess honest communication, of course, within the boundaries of personal communication and disclosure is probably the most respectful relational currency we can share with one another. I'm also pretty aware that being connected, that connected, might not fit with the paradigm people usually have of the standard vanilla military leader. So I've learned from my own experience that I have a duty to communicate across all mediums with those I work for and with, and also with those who are interested in sharing conversation with me. In fact, in 2013, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff offered that it was the responsibility of military leaders to learn how to, and I'm going to quote this, how to connect the warrior to the citizen. Now his charge was for military members to share their stories and in return listen to the different perspectives of fellow citizens and learn from them. And as a result, I consider it an honor to encourage that conversation across the board. And as a result, here we are, you and I, chatting about a shared passion, aviations and all things airplane, for that matter.
It's kind of amazing that it's come to this. You know, we like to think sometimes, folks will like to kind of possess personally the new media and this kind of communication and, you know, maybe feel that it's something special and not for, you know, the status quo or, you know, the establishment or the man, but if you will. But I mean, what you're talking about is completely the opposite of that.
It is. And in fact, you know, I preface all of my communications with, you know, these are my thoughts. This is, you know, and my thoughts are my own. I don't speak for the corporate enterprise. And there's certain topics that are taboo for me. I'll never get into the politics of a situation. You'll never hear me talk about policy. On our blog at generalleadership.com, we never delve into, the administration or how politics are going. And everything seems to try to get polarized in that environment. We focus on integrity and character, leadership topics that apply across the board, whether you're in the healthcare industry, the aviation industry, the military, you know, forum. We all share a common bond. And that's really what we're going after. There's been some studies that say that, you know, corporations across America are really concerned about how you use social media with your leadership, right? Because there's a risk there. The leader could start talking out of turn, may bring a bad light on the organization. But at the same time, we have a whole generation of young people coming in, not just to corporate America, but into the military especially, who communicate in a special way. So I feel it's my responsibility to learn how to do that that form of communication and connect with them on a personal level. And right now, our young people, America's sons and daughters, are coming to the military and they're using social media. So I engage there as an opportunity to connect.
Well, that's interesting. And for those kinds of young folks who are interested in the military and flying with the military in particular, do you have any thoughts that you would pass along to them, how they could be better prepared to serve their country and to enter into a military flying career?
Well, I'll tell you, and what I have to say doesn't just apply to a flying career. This would be You could probably apply this across the board, but we can certainly use this in the military. It's energy and passion. They're important, but they're the fuel that drive you towards the next big challenge. That said, I would say that technical proficiency and a continued and a desire to continually learn, that's what gets you accepted into the community, especially our aviation community, right? It's the coin of the realm, so to speak. And I wouldn't expect to go to a doctor who hasn't cracked a book since he graduated from medical school. And I wouldn't expect a new pilot to abandon self-improvement and training once they pin their wings on. So aviation's a great profession, but none of us are above learning or relearning to make the community a better and probably a safer place. So my advice to young pilots, stay in the books and ensure you're not only proficient, but interested in learning. Better yet, focus that eagerness in imparting your wisdom towards the next generation of young leaders, because they're eager to gain your knowledge. Just plan to pay it forward. That's my advice.
Great. Tell us about flying the KC-135. What was that like? And what are some of your thoughts and memories from that period in your life?
I love the KC-135. It's a venerable old aircraft, 1950s. And just the experience of flying in something that grandfathers flew in and fathers flew in, and have that history and experience and lore that goes with it. It's an honor and a privilege, quite honestly, to fly it. But there's also the other half. The KC-135 has one of the more modernized cockpits in our Air Force, in our manned mobility Air Force. So we've got wonderful technology up front, and it's just this juxtaposition of old cable and wire flying, hands-on flying, with amazing computer components up front that just really kind of push the boundaries of what's been done. The KC-135 has been used as a test bed for the Global Air Traffic Management Program, right up into where I think we're in our block, coming up on our block 50 very soon here, where we've got hand controllers in the armrests, large glass in the front cockpit. It's a wonderful airplane. It still flies extremely well. Although I will say we are looking very, very forward to the arrival of the KC-46, because while the KC-135 is performing admirably and has done a great job, it is still aging very quickly.
And that's powered by CFM56 engines, right?
It is an extremely reliable engine.
Yeah, for sure.
Extremely reliable. Nice round engine. It doesn't give you many inches of clearance over the pavement, so it forces the pilots to be very precise on the landings. We chose not to get the accessory pack on the edges so we could have that nice egg-shaped engine like the Southwest Airlines jets do. We have a nice round engine that's right down there close to the ground, so makes you a better pilot every day.
Now, tell us about aerial refueling and how that represents something that's important to the U.S. Air Force, and how does that compare to other countries, other air forces around the world?
Well, I mean, obviously, air refueling is critical to American air power. I think when you look back to the question mark days when Captain Smith and Lieutenant Rector took those Airco biplanes up in the air, I think that was in 1923, I believe. Ask the historian among us there, you'll probably have the answer. And they showed that we could pass fuel midair. I think even they realized how game-changing that capability could be. And since then, we in the Air Force have built our entire power projection capability around air refueling. It's one of our key enablers that allows us to access airspace and give us capability and dominance around the world. But we don't own the monopoly on it, of course. Numerous countries around the world have taken advantage of it for force extension and enabling capability. In fact, our friends in Great Britain and France and Australia and Italy, they've all benefited greatly from using it within their airborne military. We've got smaller but equally valuable partners that are growing in aerial refueling, like Republic of Singapore. I had the honor of working with them, the privilege of working with them back in the 2005-2006 timeframe in McConnell, where they partnered up with us, and the Republic of Singapore folks were integrating the tanker into their forces. In all, the U.S. has been leading the development in the standards and capabilities around the world in aero refueling, and I'm proud to have played a small part in that capacity.
Now, I understand that you were deployed to Afghanistan for a year, but before that, you were commander of some kind of a mission, Project Speckled Trout. What was that all about?
Project Speckled Trout, it's got a funny name, and in fact, I understood very little about it before I was offered the opportunity to command the unit. But it was founded actually back in 1957 by none other than General Curtis LeMay, who was at the time the the vice chief of staff for the Air Force. So he took the first KC-135 test bed. He transferred it to headquarters in D.C. there, where it was used to transport senior military leaders, and at the same time continue to do flight tests on sensitive, specialized avionics, communications programs like that. The program was actually named after a program manager who had a lot of freckles. Her name was Faye Trout, and to this day, Project Speckled Trout continues. Now it's back at Edwards Air Force Base, where it relocated in 1992. But it still continues to do flight tests and provide transportation for senior leaders all over the world in KC-135s that are really not the showcase of the unit. In fact, I was fortunate enough to command the unit from 2011 to 2013, and I still marvel at the amazing pilots and navigators, flight attendants, and comm system operators, maintainers, all of whom were hand-selected to serve in the unit and do the historic mission. So at the same time, I was fortunate to take part in some great developmental test programs, which are still paying dividends today, like the electronic flight bag, among others, that have enhanced our operations for the entire fleet.
For this Project Speckled Trout, there's a webpage, I understand, for that as well.
There is, projectspeckledtrout.com. There's a lot of folks in the history arena that really were excited by the fact that, you know, Speckled Trout is out there. In fact, when we brought it out of depot in 2012, we took it on an around-the-world kind of a ring out. You know, you got to test all the avionics and systems. You'd certainly hate to have, you know, the chief of staff on board only to find out that something's not working or the air conditioner doesn't work. So we took it around the world. And when we landed in England, I think there were pictures posted on the internet before we even touched the ground. And they were just so happy to see Speckled Trout back in service. I think they followed us all the way to Italy. There were pictures posted of us landing there at Aviano. So, yeah, a lot of excitement around a special bird like that.
That's fun. David, is there the question that I haven't thought of that you'd like to ask Matt? David's on mute.
Well, actually, I have one if we can get it in the middle. And Matt, when I used to fly, I flew a business jet years ago with a fellow who became our department manager, and he started out as a young Air Force officer flying KC-135s. And he used to talk about the fact that, you know, he learned to fly and it was really fun and he enjoyed it and he went through the Air Force and he couldn't believe that he was an aircraft commander on a KC-135 was what I at the time thought was an unbelievably long, low number of total time hours logged. Is that pretty common? I think he said he had something like less than 1,000 hours. I mean, is that kind of typical?
It's somewhat typical around the 1,000-hour mark for somebody to upgrade. You know, the beauty of our system is, you know, we employ this weapon system or any weapon system surrounded by very knowledgeable people. Now, I would say especially in the tanker fleet, in the KC-135 fleet, which had its origins and beginnings back in the old Strategic Air Command days, you're talking about a culture, a culture of continued learning and training and focus. I remember being a young co-pilot and looking at the guy who was my aircraft commander, and just the immense amount of knowledge and wisdom that was in him wasn't just what he learned from his 1,000 hours before he became an aircraft commander. It was the passed down from generation upon generation of just general knowledge and airmanship. You know, when you're flying a platform as old as the KC-135, you know what parts of that airplane are actually edible. By the way, it's the whiskey compass and the wooden plate beneath the wing the wing roof. You have that kind of a connection to the history and the background of not just the airplane but the culture. That low time isn't really a delineator. It's the amount of passion and energy that somebody displays, the maturity, the airmanship, that allows us to say you're ready to go to an aircraft commander upgrade, and it is a ringing out process when you go.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay, Matt, give me your best bar story.
my best bar story. I got to think about this one for a little bit. You know, I'll tell you, being a young mid-level co-pilot at the time, I think I was getting ready to upgrade, and we had just gone over to a base that I can't name for the operation that was just kicking off in Afghanistan shortly after 2001. And we took off and went over there, and we had a brand new, and I'm talking brand spanking new boom operator. And we were flying over Afghanistan at night. We were doing special operations, air refueling, nice and low. And we had just finished refueling with our receiver at a nice low altitude there, and not a place I really ever expected to be in a four-engine jet from the 1950s with no radar warning receivers or anything like that. And our boom operator, who has a perfect view of the battle space below him, right? He's laying on his stomach, got his chin and his little chin rest there, looking out these massive side-to-side windows, and he can see the entire ground. And he says through the microphone, "Hey, the ground is all sparkly." Now, you can imagine, for the pilot and I up in front, we look at each other, and we're like, "What do you mean the ground is all sparkly?" And he's like, And his voice went up about 8 octaves. "I think they're shooting at us. Hey, I think they're shooting at us." And sure enough, they were. And we broke away from our receiver and went into a nice retrograde climb and got ourselves up and out of there about as fast as I could. But it was just one of those moments where, you know, all you've got tying you and that boom operator at the back of the airplane sitting, you know, 100 feet away from you is that one microphone cord. And in that moment, I could feel every bit of fear and tension in his voice, and it translated straight up to the front. So that was just one of those moments I don't think I'll ever forget.
Or him either, probably.
Probably not.
Right. All right. Well, Matt, this has been terrific. Why don't you tell our listeners all the places where they can find you online?
Hey, well, I and my friends are always blogging at generalleadership.com, and that's focused on leadership, actually trying to translate military leadership to language that corporate America and the public at large can speak, and we just encourage interaction there. As well, I blog personally at advancedvectors.com, and I can be found at any time on Twitter, handle at FritzMT, that's FritzMT. Come and join me. I'd like to continue the conversation there, and I look forward to chatting with everybody in, around, and after the show.
Oh, fantastic. And finally, anything coming up for you that's interesting in your career or in your life?
Well, when I got back from Afghanistan, my family and I moved to our new home here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I just took over as the director of the National Assessment Group. It's an interesting organization. We provide assessments to the Department of Defense. And we're successful because we're small, flat, and agile. And, you know, those are, as you can probably imagine, organizational tenets that I can enjoy having the opportunity to lead. So,
sure.
Best thing about being in Albuquerque is that the weather's great all the time. There's friendly people, awesome food, and a rich military history. So the Air Force has always done a great job of keeping my life interesting and exciting. And I'm always fascinated by the opportunities that keep coming up and materializing. So who knows where the winds will blow me. But one thing I can guarantee, you can probably read about it on my blog or via my Twitter account. Either way, it'll be something I look forward to sharing.
All right, great. Matt, it's been a real pleasure.
Hey, thank you very much for allowing me to have the opportunity to be a part of your program and let my inner airplane geek out. I look forward to tuning into future broadcasts.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Inner airplane geek. I like that.
Yes, very much.
See you, Matt. Thanks.
Cheers, guys. You have a good one.
And now here's Pete Combs to tell us about the Flight Plan podcast from the National Business Aviation Association.
Hi, I'm Pete Combs, and if your business is flying, then you'll want to check out NBAA's Flight Plan. Whether you're flight crew, cabin crew, line crew, or maintenance, NBAA's Flight Plan is 5 minutes well spent on topics that range from safety to education to procedures both new and old. You'll find us on Apple's iTunes website or at the home of business aviation, nbaa.org.
Rob, did you have an opportunity to see Pete when you were down at the conference?
No, you know, in fact, it's funny. I looked for him, and I never did find him. I found a whole bunch of other aviation journalist geek type folks and photographers, but in fact, we all had a dinner together, about 30 of us on I think it was Tuesday night or something, but I never did run into Pete, and I was looking for him.
No, it's too bad. All right, another time, I'm sure. Okay, and now, with his airplane of the week, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Thought I'd do something a little different for Halloween and aircraft pretending to be things they're not. They are the MiG-28, and they carry the Exocet anti-shipping missile. Yes, it's one of those spit-out-your-coke moments in moviedom. Okay, the MiG-28 part is fake, but the real threat at the time the movie was being made was the Exocet. Throughout 1984 and early into 1985, Iraq fired 34 of the anti-shipping missiles into the Persian Gulf oil tankers. The Exocet, or flying fish, is a sea-skimming missile, over 15 feet in length and has an operational range of 97 nautical miles. In this humble historian's mind, only two aircraft can be associated with the Exocet. The first being the dreaded, feared, and bird-flicked at MiG-28. The other would be the Dassault Breguet Superintendard. It's not often that all the operators of an aircraft have actually taken them into combat, especially if the total production run of aircraft was 85 airframes. The Dassault Intendard was an aircraft first flown in 1958. 90 of the aircraft would be produced, 69 for M's, M standing for maritime, and 21 for P's, the reconnaissance version. The French Navy operated the aircraft off of the two Clemenceau aircraft carriers. The Intendard Fords were to be replaced by the SEPCAT Jaguar M. After prototype testing aboard the Clemenceau, it was decided that the Jaguar M was too expensive and Dassault proposed an improved Intendard. The Super Intendard was ordered in 1973 and the Jaguar was canceled by Parliament. The Super Intendard took to the skies on October 28, 1974, 40 years ago this week. The Snecma Altar 8B engine was replaced with an Altar 9K50 non-afterburning turbojet. The wing was strengthened and able to carry 4,600 pounds of ordnance or fuel. This gave an increase of 1,600 pounds over the original Intendard. The biggest change was the avionics. The avionics needed to support the newest weapon the Aeronavial had, the Exocet. The new system was called the Agave radar. The Agave, produced by Thompson CSF, was an essential to provide long-range acquisition for the missile. Also, the UAT-40 computer provided the pilot an integrated system for navigation, targeting, and aircraft systems management. The avionics were constantly improved, and in the mid-80s, the aircraft were given a whole new cockpit. The redesign introduced HOTAS, or hands-on throttle and stick, and the Agave radar system was upgraded to the Anemone radar, thus effectively doubling the range of the system. A mid-2000s upgrade provided better ECM, night vision capability, and laser designators. In 1978, the French Navy took delivery of the first SUs, capital S-U, lowercase U-E, superintendents, as they were called in the French Navy. The first squadron to stand up was Flotilla 11F. Eventually, three operational squadrons and an operational conversion unit would stand up. The aircraft would continue operating off of the Foch and the Clemenceau. Typical air wing consisted of five SUs. The Foch bloodied the aircraft over Syria in September 22, 1983, after the Syrian army fired on French peacekeeping troops in Lebanon. The aircraft would then receive a 73% operational rate over Serbia during Operation Allied Force in 1999. The SUs were again called into action on November 21, 2001, for Mission Heracles, the French support of Operation Enduring Freedom. They were carried into battle by the 10th French aircraft carrier, the Charles de Gaulle, R-91. The de Gaulle is France's first nuclear aircraft carrier. The SUs fought gallantly and acted as laser designators for their eventual replacement, the Dassault Rafale M's. In March of 2001, again, the aircraft would be paired with Rafales, this time over the skies of Libya, in support of Operation Haritan. Currently, only Flotilla 17F is the only Super Intendard squadron left. In response to a refusal to provide additional spare parts for the A4Qs by the United States, the Argentine Navy Aviation Forces ordered 14 Super Intendards in 1979. Five SUs were then delivered between August and November 1981. With the five came five Exocet missiles. The aircraft and those missiles would be taken into battle in May of 1982. After a failed attempt to attack the approaching Royal Navy on May 2nd, on May 4th, a pair of superintendards launched their exocets against HMS Sheffield. One missile would miss, the other would sink the destroyer. On May 25th, two more exocets were launched at the Royal Navy flotilla, and the exocets struck and sunk the Atlantic conveyor. Ironically, the conveyor wasn't the target. Chafe from other ships directed the missiles to the Atlantic conveyor unintentionally. A fifth launched missile was against the aircraft carrier HMS Invincible and missed. The Royal Navy regarded the threat so seriously that Operation Mikado was planned. The operation was to use two C-130s and 55 SAS troops to land at Naval Air Station Rio Grande, home of the 2nd Squadron, deploy the troops, destroy the exocets and superintendards, and then take off and fly to Chile. Eventually, it was determined that this operation was going to be too risky and was canceled. After the war, France delivered the remaining 9 aircraft. In 2009, France began to retire its fleet. As a result, they have stripped their aircraft so Argentina can upgrade their 11 remaining airframes to the latest standards. France, and I'm using air quotes, loaned, unquote, 5 Sioux to Iraq while they were awaiting delivery of their Agave radar-equipped Mirage F1EQs. On October 8, 1983, the first Sioux arrived. In both Iran and the United States opposed the transaction, Saudi Arabia provided funding for the loaned aircraft. They were viewed by the kingdom as a way to end the 1980 through 1988 Iran-Iraq war. Beginning in March of 1984, the aircraft would be used in what was known as the tanker war. Iraq declared that it would attack all shipping that was carrying Iranian crude. 34 exocets were fired in anger over the remaining of 1984. Iran eventually claimed that it shot down 3 superintendards. However, in 1985, after deliveries of the F-1EQs, Iraq returned 4 of the 5 leased aircraft. Interestingly enough, the one probable kill of the the superintendard, was actually by an Iranian F-14A Tomcat. So there you have it, the history of the MiG-28 carrying the deadly Exocet missile. It even gets shot down by the Tomcat. The superintendard can't be discussed without the Exocet, and the Exocet can't be discussed without the superintendard. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Well, thank you, Courtney Miller, but it's not Grant McHaren this week on the Australia Desk. It's just me, Steve Vischer. I'm giving Grant the week off. He's gone up to the New South Wales Central Coast to a huge hot air balloon festival, and he's having a great time up there, and I'm sure he'll be back next week to tell us all about that. Well, of course, as you know, I was recently over in the United States, but it wasn't all about interviewing really cool Red Bull Air Race pilots. I was also lucky enough to catch up with Rod Rakic from Open Airplane for a bit of an update on what's going on in that wonderful program.
It's great to see you again, and great to see you up and around.
Thanks, mate. It's nice to be up and around. And the last time we met was at Oshkosh in 2011, and we talked then about your exploits with the Civil Air Patrol, flying a great Australian product, the Airvan. But since then, you've been very busy, and you've actually set up a really great initiative, Open Airplane. Can you tell us a bit about the genesis of that and what you do with that?
Genesis is a good word for that. In 2011, it was just an idea. While we were at the air show, we started having conversations with folks around the industry, especially the aviation insurance industry, and we wanted to really create a way to make everybody's pilot certificate more valuable. So we really started partnering with the insurance companies first and grew from there a service that became Open Airplane. And really what we want to do there is make renting an airplane as easy as renting a car.
That's the real challenge, isn't it? When you go to get an airplane now, if you haven't flown there before, you've got to go and do a checkout, you've got to do all the insurance stuff. I guess that's where it all came from.
Yeah, it was our own frustration. It was that typically pilots are faced with having to waste half a day and hundreds of dollars anytime they go to try to rent an airplane anywhere from but their home base. And it's a bit ridiculous, and it really keeps a lot of folks from flying and keeps pilots from really getting as much value as they could from their pilot certificate, and we aim to solve that.
Now, insurance company is one thing, but interesting the setup. I mean, it must be huge. Obviously, the pilot community here in the US is much larger than in Australia or probably any other country, but I guess there's a lot of regulatory framework that you had to go through to set up. How did the FAA look upon this?
So we designed the service really to fit within the framework of the current regulations here in the U.S. And nothing that we do with Open Airplane in any way conflicts with the FARs. So we're very inspired by the sharing economy. We're very much a collaborative consumption business model. One thing that may be a little unique is we're 100% legal here in the United States.
Well, that's a good thing to hear, and I want to talk to you a bit later on about how we're going to expand this to other places, you know, like Australia, but we'll talk about that a bit later
on. Love that.
Let's talk about the Universal Pilot Checker. How does the process work? You know, you're a U.S. pilot with a U.S. certificate. You're coming in, you want to get on the program. How does it go about doing that?
The Universal Pilot Checkout does three things for the pilot. One, it resets the clock on the flight review that typically would be required every 24 months. We're going to do it every 12 months. It offers the pilot up to a 10% discount on renter's insurance. And then finally, it gives the pilot access to the same make model aircraft in a network of flight schools, FBOs, and flying clubs all across the country.
If I was an FBO operator here, and there's nothing better than the great American FBO, I'll tell you, I wish we had them in Australia on a much greater scale. But it's really an advantage to them, isn't it? It gives them the opportunity to get more pilots coming in and spending money in their business.
We think so. So when we first talked about this in 2011, it was really an idea and a business model and a concept. We took that idea and we turned it into some software and really a community of people who wanted to see this happen. And so in June of 2013, Open Airplane launched with six locations around the United States, about a couple of dozen airframes available in the network. Today, here in October of 2014, we are now in 72 locations around the United States, all across the country, including Alaska and Hawaii, with over 250 aircraft available to rent through Open Airplane. We've had over 8,000 pilots sign up and create profiles to fly with Open Airplane since we launched the company.
So it's a wonderful success, really. I mean, those numbers in Australia would be stunning to get 8,000 pilots into it. But here in the U.S., still a great start.
We've got a good running start out. We still have a lot to go. When we started, we were limited to single-engine aircraft. We were limited to aircraft at low-altitude airports. Last January, we expanded the fleet to include light twins. So we've got a growing number of light twins coming into the network now. We've got everything from two-seat LSAs to tail draggers to twins now available through Open Airplane.
You know, obviously, when we learn to fly, we learn to read charts and maps and all that sort of stuff. But there's, you know, a lot of people might be saying, well, what about local procedures? You fly in some complex airspace. I recently was flying in San Francisco. There's some very, very complex airspace there. How do you deal with that situation?
It's a great question. So we always knew that when you go to do a checkout somewhere, part of the reason for that is to sort of apply the tribal knowledge, the things that aren't necessarily on the chart or in the AFD that make flying at a particular airport more convenient, maybe safer, letting you know where the great places to fly are. All that information is usually transmitted in this kind of, you know, archaic way of, you know, let's do that while we try to bounce around the pattern. And we could do that better. So we created what we call the local procedure briefing. Every operator in the Open Airplane Network publishes information that they otherwise would have to try to jam into your head while you're bouncing around in the pattern.
Yeah, which is obvious. That's sometimes not the best way to learn it either when you're trying to, you know, fly the airplane.
The experience that we designed is that when you're on your flight to your destination, you've got that information. You can consume that on your iPad or your smartphone or your desktop computer. Make that part of your pre-flight planning, your trip planning, your vacation planning, your business trip planning. And that way, when you show up to rent with Open Airplane, you've used our software to find the aircraft that are available to rent. You've booked the reservation through our software, and you've now prepared yourself by being able to do the weight and balance for the aircraft and the tail number that you're actually going to fly, get all that detail on the avionics on the aircraft by tail number that you're going to rent that day, and really be prepared so that the experience we designed is that when you show up to fly, you are prepared as a pilot. They hand you the keys and the clipboard. They ask if you have any questions. They walk you out to the aircraft.
Fantastic. Now, foreign pilots, obviously. Now, I'm fortunate. I have a U.S. pilot certificate and an Australian pilot's license.
But for somebody coming from the UK, Canada, wherever, I guess particularly Canada when they're just across the border, is this something that foreign pilots can access as well?
Yeah, so this has been popular with foreign pilots who have converted to FAA certificates. So many pilots from abroad convert their EASA certificate or what have you to an FAA certificate. And then they can use Open Airplane to fly when they come here. Joining Open Airplane, you can do that if you're not a domestic pilot. You can input all your information. Then you can book a universal pilot checkout when you first come to the States. Now, the requirement for a foreign pilot, even if you have a converted certificate, is to have a current flight review. Well, every universal pilot checkout is a flight review. So you can really kill two birds with one stone. So we've got folks coming from Germany and Australia and all that, England, Canada, who are signing up for Open Airplane while they're at home, booking a universal pilot checkout with Open Airplane instead of just finding some random flight school to do an old-fashioned flight review. That means when they get here, they meet the requirement of having completed the flight review. They're checked out to fly at that particular flight school, but then they have this magic power. They can book and fly with over 70 locations across the U.S. while they're visiting the country.
And let's face it, if they're coming to this country, then there's a fair chance they want to travel around. That's what I've been doing the last 3 weeks.
We built this for you, Steve.
Oh, that's fantastic. I appreciate that, Rob. Okay, let's talk about expansion. Obviously, you want to expand it further across the U.S., but particularly with countries like Canada that border onto the U.S. Is this something that you see going across borders? I mean, obviously, I'd love to see something like this in my country, but perhaps a bit closer to home to start with.
The situation is that today we are limited to the U.S. market and registered aircraft. And whether you're a U.S. citizen or you're a foreign pilot coming to fly in the U.S., we're only doing N-registered aircraft in the U.S. We absolutely have our eyes on the horizon to see where else we can bring this next. Any place around the world where there's a vibrant general aviation community is a great place for Open Airplane to come next. We're really just focused on proving the model here in the U.S. We've only been doing this for just over a year now, and we want to make sure that when we go global that we've got the resources to do that. So it's really just a matter of time.
And, of course, if people want to find out more about this, if they haven't checked it out, they should go to openairplane.com.
Yes, you can go to openairplane.com, and it works on any device. There's no app to download. You can find the pilot guide. You can find the map of locations. You can sign up and create a profile so that we can keep you up to date. All at openairplane.com on a smartphone, on a tablet, on a desktop computer. It all just works.
Well, it's a fantastic concept. I wish you every success with it, and I hope we can speak again soon and you can tell us when it's coming to Melbourne.
It's great to see you again. I look forward to being able to tell you that.
And, in fact, I took advantage of Open Airplane myself and went over there to Airwork at North Las Vegas, a great FBO there, and actually took advantage of taking a review flight myself. A really good option there, as Rod mentioned, for not only US pilots, but people such as myself who have certificates from overseas coming into the US who'd like to tour around. So once again, openairplane.com. Check it out, folks, particularly if you're a private pilot. A great thing, and let's hope they see it over here or something similar to it very, very soon. Well, that's everything I've got for you this week on the Australia Desk. I'll be back next week, hopefully with Grant. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer. Cheers, folks.
Oh, great update on Open Airplane. We haven't talked with Rod Rakic in quite a while. It sounds like this is really moving along nicely.
He indeed has. I mean, it's been coming for a couple of years, and it's starting to, what would we say, roll down the hill, and the snow's getting thicker and thicker. So, and honestly, we need all the help we can get.
Yeah, this has a lot of great advantages for pilots and for people that want to continue to fly. It opens up a lot of possibilities. It's a great concept. And, of course, Rod Rakic is an amazing guy. If anybody can pull this off, well, I think Rod's the guy. All right, now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Last week, we got to talk to Marissa Garcia, of course, from FlightSheet.com. And I wanted to bring Marissa back to talk about some of the other work she does. Fantastic website. Marissa, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Peter.
thank you very much for joining us again. Too much to talk about, but you're really involved in what's going on inside the cabin, and there are some fantastic developments going on at the moment, a lot on your website. What is the sector doing?
Oh, it's doing more than it has ever done in 20 years that I've known the industry. It is the busiest time for both development, manufacturing, and innovation. The cabin is being revolutionized, and there's a lot more business out there than there ever was.
Yeah. And by business, Marissa, what do you mean? Do you mean for the manufacturers and suppliers, or for generating new revenue sources for the airlines?
No, I mean for those involved in the aircraft interiors business.
Right.
So that could be the manufacturers or the designers. You know, they're all very busy.
Yeah. And we hear a lot about IFE, and we also hear an awful lot about legroom and seats and so forth. And Europe seems to be pressing some of those buttons, particularly things like new concepts for seats. I noticed TUI Thompson looking at a hub concept for a family.
Yes, that's wonderful application of some, it's a revival of established ideas, you know, because really face-to-face seating has been out there, and some of it has been awkward.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to be face-to-face with strangers. But
yeah,
here they have taken the idea of not considering the cabin by class, instead using it by customer need. And that's a very forward-thinking way to do the cabin.
Yeah.
So if you have a family traveling together, it's brilliant.
And what about safety? I mean, we know that actually sitting facing backwards has been proved to be more safe than sitting forwards. Is there any issue with that in terms of regulations designing the cabin?
No. And again, as you said, it is safer. The main thing, and I have a little post in my blog that I did a while back ago called the forward F is back. But basically, it is safer. But the problem is the marketing of it. You know, you can't convince a whole bunch of people all to sit backwards.
Yeah.
It's just psychological. But airlines would have a challenge, I believe, in trying to make aircraft 100% aft facing. All that said, you know, people are trying to fit more into the cabin, and one of the best ways to do it is to do forward and aft in different creative ways. Some of them that we've seen, there's this one proposal from Zodiac, for example, it's been very extreme. It's almost like a, I don't know, bus flip up seat or something you'd see. Those are extremes. But, you know, there are other options like the semi wonderful business class and first class seats that are being done nested for aft and forward. And that's brilliant. I mean, that'll work just fine and people are comfortable with it. And it gives everyone a little bit more privacy. So it has many benefits.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's look outside of the aircraft. You had an item on your website recently about the new way that Airbus is printing, designing, sticking, painting their liveries. I'm not quite sure what it is, really.
They're inkjet printing it, and I thought that was just brilliant. It's very, very simple way to do complex design. So it opens up the possibilities for airlines tremendously in terms of diversifying their livery, doing product differentiation.
Yeah.
It's a very neat thing. It works just like an inkjet at home. It uses the same basic colors, you know, the CN and the magenta and the yellow one.
Yep.
It's really it's something completely different, which is nice to see an airframer do that. You know, Johnny Clark from the designer had a good point on it, though, which is that we hope that airlines don't get so carried away with creativity that they generate icons which are almost imperceptible from a distance, because that's important to the airline brand, that you can appreciate the livery up front, up close, and in the sky wherever possible. So
yeah, that's true, isn't it? Sometimes when you give a designer rope, they will take it. And we've seen some amazing aircraft liveries in the last decade or two. Do you think with this technology that's likely to continue?
Oh, I certainly think so. I think Airbus thinks so too, or they wouldn't have developed it.
Yeah.
It's great. You know, just the other advantage, the big advantage, is that it's healthier. because I don't know if you've ever been in a paint shop before, but it's a very toxic environment. You know, people are having to have all sorts of masks on. Whereas with the inkjet printer, there's far fewer emissions. It's a nicer, cleaner environment for the workers. And I think that's the biggest thing to be excited about.
Well, we look forward to some new designs there. You've been very busy. I think I tried to speak to you. You were in Hamburg. Then last week, you were in the US. I noticed, I think yesterday, you were on a KLM flight. You've been really busy. What's going on?
Oh, well, I've been blessed. I have a lot of activities and conferences to attend, and some lovely invitations. I was in Hamburg for the Qatar A380. That's why I was there. And, you know, all of these things are lovely. It's nice. You have to be flying in order to cover aviation. I think that's a pretty key requirement. So it's exciting to see all the things that are going on.
And what were you in the U.S. covering?
I was covering the SCIFT Forum. It is a wonderful jam. It was a session packed full of information on travel experiences. And I know it was their first year, and they're going to be doing another one next year. I really look forward to it because it was revolutionary. You just got insight from the top people in travel. And it was just eye-opening. It was brilliant.
Well, I did send you a message that came back, and I noticed that it was something like 4 a.m. local time. So you were very busy, of course. Marissa, thank you very much for joining us again. Just a reminder, where can we find you online?
Flightsheet.com.
And on Twitter, the same as well?
No, at DesignerJet. Someone took Flight Chic on Twitter, and it's just an egg sitting on it, which is annoying, but it's DesignerJet.
Right. Okay. Marissa, thank you very much again for joining us.
Thank you.
I think Marissa Garcia is an amazing journalist and blogger, well worth following. I guess I said that last time, but I'll say it again because I think it's true. All right, we've got a couple of listener mails. Rob, these are really kind of all for you in a recent Aviation Minute. This first one comes from, well, a different Rob. And he says, absolutely love the show, due in large part to your consistent technical accuracy. He says, one exception, in episode 320, you blame the Asiana Airlines deaths on passengers not wearing seatbelts. I think that probably warrants a correction. Gross pilot error with the clear overarching cause, coupled with the fact that at least one passenger was killed only after being run over by a fire truck. You guys rock, love the show, and this certainly won't stop me from listening or referring the show to others. So, Rob, I think you answered our listener, but maybe you can give us all your response.
Well, I think the point was that you know, we didn't seem to be on the same page. I mean, he was citing the pilots as the cause of the accident. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. The pilots were in command. Certainly, there are extenuating circumstances about why they either were or were not paying attention to what was going on. I was simply making the point that it seemed like if there is such a thing as a pointless death. Losing people out the back end of an airplane because they didn't have their seatbelts fastened was just the most unbelievable thing I could imagine. And that was at least the point I was trying to make. If that didn't come across, well, that's what it was at least.
Yeah. I mean, you weren't blaming the passengers.
Well, I don't think I was, but I mean, if you wanted to lay blame, I mean, I think there was plenty of blame to go around in that accident.
Yeah.
But let's be serious. You don't put your seatbelt on. It's not the pilot's fault. I mean, it's not the flight attendant's fault when you've got 200 and some people on an airplane. They can't look at every single person and make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do.
You know, when people I know, acquaintances, particularly people who are not, you know, aviation savvy, let's say, are going on a trip and maybe ask me for some sort of travel advice or, you know, things that they should be paying attention to or whatever. I think the thing I mention more often than anything else is when you're on that airplane, And unless you've got a really, really good reason not to be wearing your lap belt, keep that thing on just all the time. It's, you know, I just don't advocate the position you see some people is, you know, as soon as the seatbelt light goes off, unbuckle and, you know, roam about the cabin. I like to stay fastened in.
Well, and nor do I like something I've seen quite a bit of in the last couple of days, having been, you know, Chicago, Orlando to Albuquerque and back to Chicago, lap children, people carrying little babies on their laps to save a buck. And it just, I don't say anything to them because it's not my job to be their grandparent, but it just drives me crazy because these people don't realize that if there was ever a sudden bump or, God forbid, an accident, that there's no way they'd be able to hold on to that baby.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Rob, for sure. Well, we also heard from Christopher. He said, I've been a regular podcast listener for approximately 6 months. Thank you, Christopher. He says, in episode 320, same one, Rob was wondering how to get people to look up from their devices during the safety briefing so that they could pay attention. My suggestion is if they want to access the Wi-Fi in flight, include the password for accessing the Wi-Fi at the end of the safety briefing. If you want the password, you'll be forced to pay attention to the briefing. As an added measure to ensure that someone listened to the briefing, after someone enters the password and is connected, they are asked a question about the safety briefing, much like entering a username and password after connecting to a Wi-Fi network at home. So I thought that was a pretty clever approach. There's probably a lot of other ideas floating around out there that would help people pay attention to the safety briefing, but this is kind of a big problem.
Yeah, it is. There's no doubt about that. And but you know, again, all we can do is try.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to thank Christopher for writing in. Also, thank Rob for writing in as well. We had some other listener mail, but we're going to kind of limit this to those two this episode. But we want to thank everyone for sending it in. We do read them all, even though we don't have the opportunity to mention everyone on the show. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode. Want to thank you for listening to episode 322 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Or you can go straight to the show notes for this episode by visiting airplanegeeks.com/322. And again, our guest was Matt Fritz. Want to thank him so much for spending some time with us. He's the senior military leader and a leadership author. You can find him at advancedvectors.com, also generalleadership.com. And his Twitter handle is FritzMT, FritzMT. You can find out more about us and our contributors at airplanegeeks.net. That has links to our websites, recent episodes, blog posts, tweets, contact information, and more. And that's for this podcast, Airplane Geeks. Also, the Jetwine blog, the UAV Digest podcast, the What Just Flew By blog, and the Plane Crazy Down Under and Aviation Extended podcasts. You'll find all that at airplanegeeks.net. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you for listening.